Hey everybody, this is DJ Q for the Golf News Met Radio Network. We now return you to Jay's Place, already in progress.
All right, one more time, thank you DJ Q for bringing us back from Commercial in Style. He is the very best in the business. I am indeed Jay Plummer, and you are listening to Jay's Plays on Golf News Net Radio Network. What a fantastic show we've had, everybody. I've had so much fun talking to Art Spander, a 50-year veteran of everything from Wimbledon to the U.S. Open to the Super Bowl, Rose Bowl, and even the Lower Oakland Roller Derby Finals. And we had a terrific time taking a quick trip out to Boston and talking to PGA head professional Stephen Clancy and golf course architect John Sanford. Show was fun meeting his Chinese food delivery man. I've never had that happen in a radio show. Coming up right now, I don't know if we're getting a Chinese food delivered. It more likely might be spaghetti bolognese because we're bringing back an old favorite for our final segment. Please welcome a man who also celebrates more than 50 years in the media tent. He's covered the Pittsburgh Steelers when they won their Super Bowls. He covered the Pittsburgh Pirates when they won the We Are Family World Series. He covered the Penguins, the Penn State Nittany Lions, and Joe Paterno. And he's been to so many U.S. Opens and Masters and U.S. Opens and British Opens that, you know, he's getting pretty close to Dan Jenkins. Please give a warm Jay's Place welcome back to Marino Paracenzo.
Oh, you said it right, too. By Jove.
Oh, yeah, I'm Italian. It's in the vowels, okay? Sono italiano in spirito. You know, it's great. I used to hold my girlfriend's face in her hands, or in my hands, and say, quando se mangia, numerone se mangia, se beve, se lava la faccia. And she'd melt and say, oh, you're so romantic. And she had no idea what I said.
For that matter, neither did I.
I said, when you eat a watermelon, you eat, you drink, and you wash your face.
Oh, for God's sake.
Marino, how have you been? How was your PTA championship? How was your Wyndham championship? And how are things shaping up for you for the FedEx playoffs?
Well, all's well and good. All is exciting. Well, exciting insofar as golf is concerned. I am all out of sorts, however, when they switch this season thing. You know, this wraparound season. I don't know that it makes any difference at all. It just feels alien to me. You know, the golf season is supposed to end at the end of the summer, not wrap around off into the winter and all of that. Maybe I'm used to basketball. God knows I covered enough basketball, so I'm used to wraparound seasons, and the same in hockey, the wraparound season. I have no problem with that. But for some reason, I just can't quite get a grip on golf wrapping around. It just doesn't make it's all out of sorts, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, it's probably because there really is nothing important of note once the FedEx Cup playoffs, you know, are done. It's silly season events and made-for-charity events and made-for-TV events, you know, and then come January, those of us, especially up north, might take a peek at Kapalua or at the Sony, you know, before hibernating for a couple more months till, say, perhaps, Riviera. You know, and then the Masters heralds the beginning of the season.
You did that anyway, you know. You watch the winter events that were held in Hawaii and California and whatnot. I think the principal value of the wraparound season is the guys who are struggling get a shot at four or five whatever tournaments there are at the end of the year, which are actually the start of the new season. And they can make a buck, and they can win a card, and they can make a name for themselves. Apart from that, you know, and as I said, it really, functionally, it doesn't make any difference. But it just seems out of sorts. That's the best I can say.
Do you take the FedEx Cup seriously? You know, how important is the FedEx Cup to you? And
not
I mean as a journalist.
I don't look on it like the National Football League playoffs, the Baseball League playoffs. They're a function of Tim Finchem's terrific salesmanship. He got FedEx to put up, you know, all this money they're putting up, and he's lined up these tournaments. It's a beautiful package. It's well done. But I shrug my shoulders. I'm saying, oh, okay. So the guy goes into the Tour Championships, and he wins the tournament and also the FedEx Cup on the same day, and he makes $11.4 million. And you say, well, okay, so what?
It would really be better if the final was match play. You get the last 16 guys. And, you know, what to do with match play events so that you're not looking at only four golfers is, even if a guy loses, he continues to play all week so that, you know, not only do you have, you know, the number one and the number two guy in the one, you know, in the championship game, and the number three and the number four guy in the consolation game, but people will actually play out to fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, 11th, 12th, you know, through 16th. Maybe even through 32nd, to keep more guys in.
Television will never buy it. Who's going to watch it?
Well, you know, it gives us more to watch. You know, if they're making good golf shots, we do that all the time, though. We watch guys that are 10 shots out of the lead play all weekend.
No,
you know, we don't only watch the final group.
Only because they're there, because you know the winner's going to come out of somewhere there. But when you're, if you're watching two guys playing for third place, I don't care how many good golf shots they're hitting, you're yawning. You're not even watching. You're off doing something else. That's why you don't see that much match play.
I'd like to see them give it one shot. I think that with the truly great names still in there, the problem with match play is if you've only got two guys playing or four guys to play them or even eight guys playing, the fact that the casual slings of arrows of match play will take out a lot of the marquee names and leave you with some chaff instead of some wheat is obviated when you have the wheat that gets eliminated in the first round still playing to see how far along they could come. And we give a guy a chance who maybe lost in the first round, you know, to play his way up rather high on the ladder anyway and have a really great week, you know, and earn the money rather than, you know, being down the road and you get stuck watching, you know, Marino Paracenzo versus Jay Plummer in one final, and, you know, Tom Rinaldi versus Bob Herrig in the other final.
let me tell you this. You would never be my TV producer or whatever function that is. You would never put a TV show together for me.
I do it all the time, Marino, but they come to me because I'm forward-thinking.
What you're talking about is suicide, airtime suicide. That's why they don't do it.
Yeah, well, you got it. That's what they think is suicide. But remember, these are the same people that keep showing us Tiger Woods eating a banana, Tiger Woods looking
that's
at the
right.
yardage
that's
book,
right.
tight, you know. And so while we're on the topic, what were your impressions of the Wyndham Championship?
Well, you're talking to me, actually, about what are my impressions of Tiger Woods in the Wyndham Championship. He was making one last stab. He wasn't very convincing. He wasn't very productive. He didn't play very well. He's still not the old Tiger Woods, and I'm getting more and more the impression that he may never be the old Tiger Woods again. He's 39 now, creeping into 40. Now, the old Tiger Woods was fabulous. The new Tiger Woods could be okay, but the trouble is you're still comparing him to the old Tiger Woods.
And the worst trouble is that you're comparing him to the new Jordan Spieth and the new Rory McIlroy.
I'm disturbed about the shots he's hitting. Those are the things that are troubling me. He's talking about how he's lost some length. Well, I understand that because he used to snap that left knee into place. That's what ruined him, in my opinion.
Yeah.
He snapped that left knee and wore out his cartilage, but he got the extra 20 yards. He was stupendously long before everybody else became stupendously long. Now he's still really, really long, but not as long as some of them, maybe not as long as, say, Dustin Johnson. But the rest
Jason Day sure looked long at the PGA Championship.
Yeah.
He had six drives in excess of 400 yards.
Yeah, well, those are those fairways up there and all that. But nevertheless, he did cover the 400 plus. The other thing alarming, if I were a Tiger Woods fan, the other thing that would alarm me is, number one, he doesn't have control of his driver as well as he used to. Two, he doesn't hit it as far. And three, the key to his game used to be the second shot. He was just fabulous with his second shot, and he doesn't have that anymore. So I don't. And then he gets on a green, and he's missing short putts. You wonder what's left. I don't know what's left. And is it coming back? Well, I don't know. He has this new coach. Well, the newest coach. What's his name? Como?
Yes, Chris
and
Como.
And everybody was touting him because he showed you how he could jump off a 30-meter platform at a pool and do a golf swing on the way down. And I said, my God, that is just wonderful. How does he tee it up when he's on his way down? What the hell are you talking about? He can do it.
Chris Como, yeah, he was so obscure as a swing coach as Chester A. Arthur is as a president.
As a president. Yeah, so that tells you Tiger's grabbing at anything, just anything at all. He had Sean Foley for a while.
Another name out of the blue.
Yeah, and I'm not saying he did or didn't have the answer. I'm only saying Tiger's grabbing at anything. He sacked Butch. He sacked Hank. He got Sean. He sacked him. Now he's got Como. He's going to sack him eventually. Maybe me next. Maybe you. You better than me because you know golf. But you know the golf swing better than I do. But I wouldn't trust you either, though, to tell you the truth.
Not as far as you could kick me, which isn't very far. Nonetheless, we had a phenomenal season this year, okay?
Oh,
all
yeah.
of the young Lions roared.
There's a bunch of them. There's an astonishing amount of talent coming up. Oof.
So besides Jordan Spieth, who is going to get my vote for Player of the Year so far...
Sure,
yeah. But besides Jordan Spieth, who were the people that impressed you the most?
Well, Jason Day, whom I've been watching for a while, and I think he's coming into his own. Of course, he's going through that vertigo thing, too. That's not going to help at all. But Jason Day impresses me. Dustin Johnson, as long as he doesn't think, which sometimes I think is a... is a difficult problem for him. I can't bring him up off the top of my head, but there's a bunch of guys that are playing so beautifully now, and you just the names they don't ring any bells. They don't, as they say, move any needles. But these guys can play.
Well, they're going to move needles soon.
Of course, with Rory. Don't forget Rory McIlroy. If he hasn't screwed up his ankle altogether with coming back so soon, that would have cautioned me right there.
You know, it was interesting. We had Dr. Russ LaFrance on our show the week that Rory got hurt, and he said
an orthopedic guy.
Not only is he a sports orthopedic guy, trained at the famous Job Center in Los Angeles. He worked on the Lakers. He worked on the Dodgers. He worked on the Raiders.
Okay.
And all of this for UCLA, USC. He said that the breadth of that injury is remarkable because it can be anything from a week to a year, depending on how severe. And basically what happened in essence was Rory rolled the ankle outward running to chase somebody, okay? He was running down the field, and, you know, either the ground was uneven or there was some little pothole or something, and as he was in full stride, the ankle just rolled outward, okay? And when that happens, you go down in a heap. I know. I've done it, okay? I had to chase the guys down on the soccer field all the time from behind, and I remember one time in a game, chasing a guy full steam and having that ankle roll and face planting into the turf immediately. You go down like a sack of potatoes that second. But sometimes you can get right back up and you're going to be okay. It just hurts for a little bit. And sometimes it's much worse. It seems like Rory's ankle was strong enough for him to be competitive that soon. So I'm not fearful yet. You know, if something else happens or if, you know, he injures it again, I'll start to worry, but I think he's on the way to full recovery.
Well, you might be, unless he's weakened it and he got by with 1 week. Meanwhile, what's your opinion of a pro golfer doing soccer like that, risking, you know, the Jim Lomborg. Are you familiar with Lomborg?
I know, very much so, Jim Lomborg. He was the famous pitcher for the Red Sox.
Right.
Jim Lomborg, everybody, was a pitcher for the Boston Red Sox. And wasn't it a skiing accident, Marino?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here's my opinion, and now remember, you're talking to a guy whose primary sport actually was soccer. I played for years. I played in Italy. I played here in America.
Go ahead.
Well, I know you don't like it, okay? I love it. You know, but at the end of the day, it's not a boys will be boys thing, you know, where he was doing something wrong. You've got to let a guy have a little fun, okay? You know, he's got to be able to have a chance. They were 6-on-6. They were trotting around. You know, it's not like a dangerous activity. He wasn't riding a motorcycle without a helmet. You know, he wasn't rock climbing without carabiners or without ropes. You know, he wasn't driving a race car with no experience.
So you think it was all right for him to play soccer?
You know, remember, soccer's not supposed to be a contact sport, and you would think that Rory and his pals would be smart enough, you know, that they would know that they're playing with Rory McIlroy, and they really don't want to, you know, wreck his ankles or his knees or hurt his career, so that they're not going to be so stupid as to fly tackle him. That is not what happened. Rory did not get fly tackled, you know, nor was there some sort of supersonic collision for the ball. You know, so in this particular instance, you know, you can't fault the guy for wanting to have a little fun. To be perfectly honest with you, I'm also a skier, Marino, and it would really, if I had to make the choice between millions of dollars and no skiing, I'd make the choice for the millions of dollars. But at the same time, you know, you gotta let a guy lead an ordinary life. And in the UK, kicking around a soccer ball is an ordinary life. Okay, it's no different than if Jack Nicklaus was throwing a football with his son and accidentally dislocated his arm or his shoulder. You know, you can't blame a guy for living a normal life. What's your opinion of it?
I agree. I'd hate to see these accidents ruin a career like that. But in the team sports, it's a lot different. In the Lomborg case, and I think most pro contracts now carry a prohibition of some kind against doing dangerous sports, such as skiing or skydiving or something like that, where you have a very definite risk of damaging goods, and the goods is under contract to a team. Now, in the case of a golfer, he's under contract to nobody except himself, and I'm not talking about the endorsement contract. I'm talking about He's not stuck with a team of some kind. He's his own man.
He is stuck with a team.
Well, he hurts his own career. That's all he hurts.
Well, you know, in Rory's case, though, he's stuck with a team. Nike. Okay?
Oh,
Nike.
No, no.
That's what team. Okay?
Well, maybe Nike,
you know,
has a prohibition then. That's a different
matter. That's the possibility. Okay, I would imagine that Nike would have a prohibition in their contract saying, hey, by the way, we're putting $50 million, $20 million, whatever it is, into you and a huge bonus.
Yeah,
don't
exactly.
Go getting hurt doing something, though.
We haven't heard anything from Nike on this, have we? I haven't.
No, we have not heard word one. That indicates to me that Rory should be okay. And again, it's consistent with what we know, which is Rory came back, you know, after a month, and competed at a high level. Sure, he didn't win, but he played pretty darn good, and he played very well, you know, for coming off of what could have been, and maybe even was, a very serious injury. Now, don't forget, A, he's also got the best doctors in the world, okay? I go to Dr. Russell France, you know, who's phenomenal, and I love him. It's great having a sports doctor that does teams take care of me. You know, but Rory has on command an entire phalanx of Dr. Ross LaFrance's working for him, you know, 24/7, 365. If he wanted a hyperbaric chamber, who was it that's left in the hyperbaric chamber? Was it Lynn Swann or who was the receiver? No, the one for the...
I don't think Lynn Swann would have done that.
No, it was... Lynn Swann took ballet lessons, though, and Hines Ward used to get manicures. Yeah, Hines used to tease Hinesworth for getting managers. But you know, there was somebody that slept in the hyperbaric chamber a la Michael Jackson before games. I think it might have been one of the Niners, if I'm not mistaken. That was the one you should ask our expander.
No, I don't recall that one, but I wouldn't want to be too close to that guy for very long.
But the point being that, you know, Rory had, you know, a phalanx of guys looking at this thing and caring for it every second 24/7, you know, and there wasn't going to be a moment that he wasn't going to be thinking about doing the right thing to get back in time for play very quickly. So,
well, unfortunately, as a writer, you can't get access to the doctor and ask a doctor what's his advice. I remember when Tiger Woods had his knee surgery, I did a long piece on him, and I tried to talk to his doctor in Utah. I think he was in Utah, as I recall. And there was no getting near him. He wasn't going to take any calls. He wasn't going to answer any questions. He wasn't going to do an interview. And these were routine questions. I would imagine the same thing applies to Rory McIlroy's doctors. They have the doctor-patient privilege, of course.
Right.
But in addition to that, I think there would be just an additional prohibition by the golfer that the doctor ain't allowed to talk.
I'm also certain.
Ask that doctor, what was your advice on this?
I'm curious. I'd love to also see if you could get an interview with Tiger's dentist as well after that Skeletor mask incident.
Yeah. That was such a nice, neat break. Do we have an agreement that tooth might have been knocked out on Thanksgiving night or whatever it was in 2009?
Well, you know, I'm not going to mention who it was, but there's a lot of speculation at the rail at the media center when Tiger comes up to do his interviews. There used to be a time, and you can look at the film yourselves, everybody, there used to be a time when one of his teeth was a brighter color or a darker color, I can't remember which, I think it might have actually been a darker color than all the rest of them because it wasn't getting as much blood, you know, so you could see, with, you know, a tooth was injured in some way, shape, or form. But that Skeletor mask had to be one of the best comedy scenes of the entire year.
that was so ridiculous. That was unbelievable.
So, well, anyway, now, before we let you go, happily, the U.S. Open is coming back to Pittsburgh next year to my absolute all-time, hands-down, all-belts unified favorite, Oakmont.
Wow, okay.
So, you're the man who wrote the book about the place. Tell us about Oakmont Country Club.
Well, let's see. I'll try to sum it up real fast. It was founded by a guy who took up golf late because he got a bad diagnosis. He was the son of an immigrant family from England. He worked in a foundry, in a family foundry, and grew up and became an officer. Started making dough. He was a bicyclist and everything else because golf was very young at the time in the U.S. This is in 1903 or late 1800s. Let's see. The reason he took up golf, this is the only golf course in the world that I can think of that was founded as a direct result of a flat tire on a bicycle.
Yeah, really?
I thought you'd like that. He was a bicyclist. His tire went flat. He had to repair the tire. Now, this is a man with all kinds of dough, but he's self-sufficient. He's going to repair it himself, and it involved using a hot wire to seal the patch on some kind. Remember, we're talking late 1800s or, 1899, thereabouts. And he got to heat this wire to make this patch, and he uses a burning torch from the foundry. Subsequently, he's having spots in his eyes. He goes to a doctor who says, you have arteriosclerosis, you're going to die in 6 months. So go out and have a good time. So he leaves the business. I don't mean he abandoned it, but he has the death sentence. And he goes off with these spots in his eyes, and he's traveling one thing and another. And one thing I couldn't pin down was whether he actually went to Britain or not. There's very thin evidence from the family. But at any rate, he became acquainted with golf thereby, and took it up and liked it a lot. Meanwhile, subsequently got a correct diagnosis where the doctor said, no, you don't have arteriosclerosis. You're not dying. You have spots in your eyes because you had that goddamn torch without using a mask. Pardon me for swearing. You were using that torch without a mask. That's what happened. So in the meantime,
and that, what did that do to him?
Well, it made it. By this time, he's in his 40s, and he thought he was dying. That's why he was traveling. Well, he took up golf and he liked it, and he became very good at it.
No, what I mean is, what did using the torch without the mask on ultimately do to him?
You have to use a mask which has a heavy window on it, a clouded window.
Yes, a tinted window, or else you're going to get...
You're going to get spots, and you're going to damage your eyes. You're going to...
Yes.
You know what a welder's mask looks like. Well,
of course. For the viewers, I just wanted to impress upon them that instead of getting arteriosclerosis, he just sort of had a temporary blindness.
He had temporary spots, and fortunately they cleared up. Meantime, he became good at golf, and he became so good at golf that the little courses around Pittsburgh were rudimentary, really. Couldn't hold him, and he wanted to get a course that had some bite to it. He eventually formed a company, found some land, open farmland, up over the Allegheny River, and founded Oakmont. And the way he structured the thing, he always had at least 51% ownership in his ventures, so he owned Oakmont Country Club at the time. And he laid it out, and he built it. And he had never had any experience at designing golf courses. So that's his baby all the way. And... go from there. His son followed him, W.C. People thought W.C. was the guy that was responsible for Oakmont becoming such a really hard golf course. Some think it's the hardest in the world. I can't answer that, but I know it's damn hard. My contention in my history was that anything W.C., the son, did on the golf course, he either got his orders from his dad, or if they were his own ideas, his dad approved them or disapproved them. So
now,
Oakmont is the dad's golf club.
Now, I remember one of the things that you once told me about Oakmont that I've always remembered. Okay, it doesn't have a single water hazard on it. There's no ocean.
That's
okay,
right.
There's no pond. There's no out of bounds. But just...
There's out of bounds, but on
the road.
Of course, yeah.
Yes, around, but no internal out of bounds.
Oh, no,
but
certainly not.
You get off of there, and you look at your card, and you wonder, how the hell did I get beat up so bad?
Yeah, that's the funny thing about it, because you're hitting the ball around like you always do, and you're putting, and then you walk off and say, where the hell did that score come from? It's just a plain brutal golf course. I there's no other way. I don't know if you say let's go out and play today, we can go to Oakmont. I may not say no. I don't care. I don't know. Never mind.
I would
do that again.
I'd go play Oakmont. Okay, you sounded like Jack Nicklaus for a second there when Nicklaus famously said, yeah, when I play Pebble Beach, I love being a golfer. When I play Spanish Bay, I'm making proud to be a golfer. When I play Spyglass Hill, I wish I went fishing. But the reason why Oakmont...
That is, by the way, an amazing thing to me about Oakmont is that it has no water hazards. No forced carries, like no canyons, no chasms, nothing like that. Everything's just right there for you to play.
Yeah. Well, here's a great stat for you, okay? Oakmont, Oakland Hills, Winged Foot, and Olympic Club combined those 72 holes. How many water hazards are there?
Oh, that's interesting. I guess none of them, I guess, now that you mention it. Oakland Hills doesn't have one, does it? No.
It is two, yes. Number 16, they have a pond.
Okay.
And on number 5, they have a creek.
Okay.
But that's pretty much it.
I can't recall them offhand the way you do, but...
5 is the hole where T.C. Chen infamously became 2 Chip Chen, and he took an 8. okay, leaving Andy North to battle Dave Barr for the title. And the 16th...
For those who want to argue a point, it's not a water hazard. They have lateral hazards, and they're lateral because they're simply drainage ditches. When in case of heavy rains, they carry the water off, but there's no water in them. The
yes.
point being that when you go into these ditches, you play them as a lateral hazard.
Yes,
but
there
not
are
a
the
water hazard.
They are the drainage ditches. That
right.
is correct.
Right.
But they weren't designed to be the primary hazards of the golf course.
Oh, no.
They happen to be
functional. They're functional.
Yes. They're off the fairway, but the thing is the fairway slope mine are so narrow and the rough is so thick that balls end up in those things if you really get offline and start hitting it sideways. So they occasionally come into play, you know, more so for the amateurs than they do for the pros. But what makes Oakmont so difficult and what I think so wonderful is three things. One, when the holes dogleg in awkward places. Two, the fairways are canted and rolling, so you have uneven lies, which makes you have to shape your shots, or at the very least, factor in the lie. And three, they've got some of the most curvaceous greens in creation, and they are wild undulations that are completely haphazard.
Oh, they are.
You know,
and
Tiger Woods said,
you've touched on an interesting point, and I like to address this. There have been those who call Oakmont a tricked-up golf course, and they point to a number of holes, about four, number 1, number 12, number 3, as I recall, number 10, maybe 15, that fall away from the golfer. You're hitting to a green that falls away from you just slightly.
Right. Tricked up to me. That's okay.
No,
that's fair game.
No, remember, no, that wasn't tricked up at all. Remember, when Oakmont was built, you didn't have bulldozers to do all this structuring. These greens follow the natural contour of the land. And what they had in those days for doing any shaping at all was mules dragging these some kind of scrapers. So these greens weren't built that way. They were just installed that way. The ground falls away. Now, it's not severe, but it is a surprise to you to hit to a green that does not face you and rise up to meet you so that you can stick a ball on it. It's just natural. It's like a British course, really, in that respect. It follows the natural contours of the land.
And it's a golden age feature, too, okay? We used to have, remember, a true Redan runs away from the player. And that was, you know, part of the test. You were supposed to test guys hitting into sidelines. Side-hill greens, you're supposed to test them in the downhill greens, so let's test them in the uphill greens. They're supposed to be able to think their way around the golf course and use different types of shots and analyze holes differently and use several different creative ways on holes, not just the same, you know, draw off the tee fade into the green, draw off the tee, draw off, you know, draw into the pin. You can't let guys get into a rhythm. You have to test everything. You know, the one thing I don't like about the USGA is they'll test a 300-yard par 3, but they won't test a simple blind shot, you know, in the interest of fairness. Okay, what is unfair if everybody's playing the same shot?
Yeah.
Nothing, that's what. So,
I got a nice little light story I'd like to lay off on you on Oakmont. The 12th holes, it happens to be the centerpiece. It's a long par 5. And I can't recall, or maybe we don't even have the name of the golfer, but he hits his third shot away. He's a good golfer, and he hits a gorgeous wedge. He floats it beautifully to the green, and he sees it hit and settle, and it's doing a little roll. And he's very satisfied, and he hands the wedge to the caddy, and the caddy says, "Keep it. You're going to need it." Just think of that. I am dead certain he hit the green. Sure enough, he gets to the green. His ball ain't on. His ball is rolled off. And then he starts to go mad. You know, it just works on your mind. It drives you crazy.
Yeah, because then you're in that deep rough, and it's murder chipping out of that all day.
Fairway. And he hit from the fairway. He hit a beautiful shot from the fairway. Well, Pat Bradley, when they played the Women's Open, the first hole, she hit a good drive. Now, they played women's tees. They played them up, of course. But she hit a good drive, and she hit a perfect 5-iron, and she was very happy and found her ball way off the back of the green in a rough. And she's saying, what in the hell is just going on here? But that's it, it just ruins your mind. The place ruins your mind.
But you love it and you want to come back. Marino, tell everybody where they can read your articles online.
Oh, Jay, I'm not writing online at the moment. I used to write for CyberGolf, as you know, as you did. I'm not online anymore. I'm doing mostly magazine stuff, and I'm writing a golf anthology. And I write for a periodical a magazine in Pittsburgh, comes out quarterly. I do a little sports column once a quarter on golf, on anything really.
Well, what else are you working on where people might be able to go out and buy copies of your stuff and read your columns?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there is any place right now. No, I'm sure there isn't.
Well, guys, I remember having so much fun. I had you on my nightstand as a kid. Now I happily have you on speed dial for sage wisdom and advice and a laugh or two and a great dish of pasta when we get together at the tournament. Everybody, Big Jay's Place, welcome from Marino Paracenza. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're quite welcome. My pleasure, Jay.
Everybody, we will be back soon with another Jay's Place show.
We're at the end of another great Jay's Play show, but thank you all so much for joining in. It's no fun doing this to an empty room, but it sure is fun doing it for all of you guys, so thanks so much. I want to thank Fish for kindly letting me use their great music as the theme song for the show. Thanks, guys. I want to thank CyberGolf and Golf News Network, cybergolf.com/writerscorner, including me and all the other fine writers, and thegolfnewsnet.com/radio. Take us home, DJ Q.
Tune in next time for another great Jay's Plays show on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
Thanks, guys. Catch y'all next time.